You know, I think this is one of the traits of a really good producer. Keep the talent happy.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We got some really urgent news here, Cyrus. I don't know if you've seen this yet. This could change everything for you, for a lot of people.
All right, I'm going to sit down.
I hate to be the one to have to break this news, but Taco Bell's menu has been hit by a nationwide shortage of ingredients.
No!
Are you sitting down? Okay, so Taco Bell announced online, they said, sorry if we can't feed your current crave due to national ingredient shortages and delivery delays. We may be out of some items. This is courtesy of CBS News. Those who frequent Taco Bell, you know who you are, Cyrus. Those who frequent Taco Bell turned to social media to share their culinary disappointment. One person tweeted, Taco Bell employee told me there was a national shortage of everything right now, and I have decided to get my economic news exclusively from drive-thru employees from now on. More specifically, a multitude of complaints on social media pointed to a lack of beef, chicken, hot sauce, and 10-inch tortillas at the Yum Brands division of Taco Bell. They run 7,500 plus or minus Taco Bells, most of them in the United States.
Well, good thing none of those ingredients are in their food.
That's a lot of refried beans. 7,500 Taco Bells. Taco Bell has a district-wide shortage of hot sauce. Times are tough, tweeted one patron. For anyone craving Taco Bell tonight, I'll save you the drive. They don't even have chicken or beef. It's a national shortage or something. I just ate black beans in a hard shell. That doesn't sound very appetizing. Similar complaints were lodged on Reddit. One person said they couldn't make any burritos since they were out of 10-inch tortillas, and none of the tacos had lettuce or tomato on them. I went back through the drive-thru and asked about it, and they said they are pretty much out of anything that comes fresh. Taco Bell declined to specify what items were in short supply, but they did say due to national transportation delays happening throughout most of the industry, we may temporarily be out of some items. Apologies for the inconvenience and hope to feed fans our current Taco Bell cravings again soon. That didn't make much sense, did it? But hey, get this. Also, Chick-fil-A is in the news because they too are experiencing shortages. Chick-fil-A, it got so bad that they were rationing their dipping sauce at 2,600 locations around the country. And Chick-fil-A cited industry-wide supply chain disruptions. So see, Cyrus, I've been talking about this for, I don't know, about a year or so now, that in the news, there are all these reports about stuff that's being short and you can't get this, chlorine in the pool, things of that nature.
Yep, lumber. There's no lumber, so prices are through the roof.
Yeah.
It's everywhere.
And to make matters worse, I mean, as if it wasn't already a crisis that the hot sauce is running low and there are no 10-inch tortillas, they can't get enough people to work. They can't keep some of these stores open because the people, I don't know what they're doing. Are they at home playing Xbox and cashing their stimulus money checks? I don't know. But this is a real thing where companies are just scrambling to find workers and they can't find them. So it's a great time to get a job if you need a job. Also, this story is a cautionary tale. There was a Revolutionary War rifle that was made in, it was in Pennsylvania. It was around the time of George Washington. And this rifle was stolen in October of 1971 from a display case at the Visitor Center at Valley Forge State Park in PA. The case was thought to be theft proof. The New York Times is reporting on this. But someone used a crowbar to pry open the case in broad daylight soon after the museum opened, just outside of Philadelphia. Sometime later, a Boy Scout who was on tour with his Boy Scout troop noticed that the rifle, which is a 5-foot-long weapon that was made by master gunsmith Johann Christian Oerter, was missing. 47 years later, July of 2018, the man who stole the rifle, Thomas Gavin, sold it along with a trunk filled with more than 20 antique pistols and a Native American silver belt to a fellow named Kelly Kinzel, a Pennsylvania antiques dealer, who paid him $27,150 for all of that stuff. On Tuesday, Mr. Gavin, 78 years old, he's the guy that stole this originally, he pleaded guilty to one count of disposing of an object of cultural heritage stolen from a museum a charge that carries a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison. So he's 78 years old. If he gets that sentence, he'll probably end his life behind bars. He was also ordered to be held with bail set at $100,000. In February of 2020, FBI agents, they visited Mr. Gavin, who admitted that he had stolen the rifle as well as other antique guns from other museums across Pennsylvania. Mr. Gavin admitted that he stole revolvers and pistols from several institutions, including the American Swedish Historical Museum. Love that place, by the way. Awesome. The weapons, one of which had a bayonet, were made in the 18th and 19th centuries. He also confessed to stealing the silver belt and several firearms made in the 1850s from the Hershey Museum in Hershey, Pennsylvania. The rifle, here's the info. The rifle that was taken from Valley Forge was made in 1775 by a gunsmith at the Moravian settlement of Christian Spring near Nazareth, Pennsylvania. David Condon, an expert in antique firearms who examined the rifle, said its market value just for the rifle itself was $175,000. So Mr. Kinzel, the guy who bought this stuff from the original guy who stole it, and his name again is Thomas Gavin, he told the New York Times that his client discovered he had bought a stolen weapon after he read about. So he bought it from this guy. He sells it to somebody else. The somebody else read about the theft of this rifle in a 1980 book and realized that he had purchased the weapon that had been stolen. The rifle was among a number of antique firearms that were stolen from the Valley Forge Historical Society, et cetera, et cetera. So the guy, this is the thing about this story that I find so fascinating. He stole this in 1971. So all of those years go by, nearly 50 years, because it caught up with him in 2018. So let's say roughly 50 years go by and you think that you've pulled off this heist. You got away with it 50 years later. And people still don't realize that you're the guy who did that. And then bam, you get caught. So it's just, if nothing else, it's a cautionary tale, just a reminder that it always pays to live a good life, whether it's a hookup app on your phone or a stolen Revolutionary War rifle or whatever it may be. These should be good reminders for us to just do what's good and avoid what's bad. Don't you think, Cyrus? Don't you think that's a great incentive? Even if you think, man, that happened 50 years ago. I stole that rifle 50 years ago. Nobody knows.
It all comes back around.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Ain't it the truth? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Deacon Martin, waiting patiently in Gary, Indiana. Good morning, Deacon Martin.
Good morning. Conversation about the traditional mask versus the Norvus Odo. The essence mm-hmm. of the mass is summed up in a prayer that nobody hears except the deacon or the priest when they say it, because the rubric tells us to say it's inaudible. Right. And the prayer goes like this: by the mystery of this water and wine, may we come to share in the divinity of Christ, who humbled himself to share in our humanity. And nobody hears that because we say it inaudibly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you argue with Latin versus, you know, or Latin mass versus Tridentine mass versus Norvus Odo, I mean, for a priest to do a Tridentine Mass, he has to be trained. I'm trained to be a deacon, but I'm not trained in a Tridentine Mass. So if I want to do that, then I have to go for special training to get those faculties. Mm-hmm. It's not just something that comes along with the job. And, I mean, I was an altar boy, but I'm after Vatican II. My three older brothers had to learn Latin to do the Mass. My fourth oldest brother started learning Latin, but didn't have to finish. I never even had to start learning Latin. And, you know, there are words that are in the Latin Mass because Latin doesn't change. When they say them, what they meant years ago is what they still mean now, versus and when you say words in English, they're constantly changing. So, you know, people say that the it's more reverent. I've been to both, and I find the beauty in both of them. Mm-hmm. They're different day and night. And, I mean, it's, you know, if you love Christ, people say to me, how was Mass? Mass is always beautiful. I don't understand. Sometimes I come out of church and people are angry at the priest. I'm like, you weren't here for the priest. You're here for Jesus. What are you angry about? How do you come out of Mass and be angry? It still knocks my socks off when I see people that come out of church mad. Because how do you come from coming to communion with the Lord and you're angry? And, well, mm-hmm. it's not my Mass.
I don't know if you've seen this, Deacon Martin, but sometimes people can be very aggressive in trying to get out of the parking lot right after Mass. And you think, wow, that guy just went to communion and look how he's treating his fellow Catholics. I hear you. I get it. These are all things that I've talked about on the program before. So I'm on the same wavelength with you.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make that comment, you know. And now you're talking about the Judas Shuffle, which I always, you know, people always say, ask me sometimes, why do you hold your head down during Mass? I said, because you'd be amazed at what people are out there doing. I wish we could do Mass ad orientem, so I didn't have to look at the people. I mean, it's not that people free said it's back to the people. His conversation is with God on your behalf, so he doesn't have to face you to talk to God for you.
Right. And also, the tradition of the church is that we are facing God together. The priest doesn't have his back to the congregation. Everybody in the congregation has his back to the person behind them. That's the wrong way to look at it. We're all facing the Lord together. The priest and the people facing the Lord together. Yeah. Good points all, Deacon Martin. Good points all. Have you been staying healthy?
Yes, I have. Yes, sir. Everything's well. Everything's good here.
That's good. Well, I wish you all of God's blessings in your ministry, and I always enjoy it when you call. Thanks for waiting as long as you did, and thanks for calling today. Let's go to Michelle now in New Jersey. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you? I am a lifelong Catholic, and and you know, the church was starting to get to me very liberal, and then the COVID happened, and I felt completely abandoned by my church. And so I found myself in an SSPX church because they were open and unafraid. And I found that the priests were unbelievably brave, and they speak of hell and sin. And I have three teenage girls who all felt compelled to go to confession after going there. And so I'm extremely grateful for the SSPX. And so I'm wondering if it's considered outside of the Catholic Church. Like, is it a bad thing? Because I feel very happy there. And I don't know.
Yeah, the answer to the question is difficult to give, because even canon lawyers are puzzling over what is the precise status of the SSPX. It started in schism insofar as Pope John Paul II declared that Archbishop Lefebvre and the four priests that he ordained to be bishops, this is back in 1988, that they had incurred for themselves, they had incurred excommunication because this was a schismatic act. And even from that point forward, it was not clear, at least in the minds of many people, does that mean that if Archbishop Lefebvre and the four bishops are in schism, does that mean that the people who adhere to the SSPX, are they in schism? And there was a long, long arguments on this very issue. And even to this day, it's not entirely clear what is their exact status. Now, we can say a few things for sure. The SSPX does not recognize, or does not at least submit to, the authority of the local bishop. If they're operating a chapel in, you know, whatever the diocese may be, they don't look to that bishop as having any authority over them. So that's a problem. Pope Francis recently gave the SSPX priests faculties to hear confessions and to officiate at weddings. So that seems to have kind of regularized them in a certain sense, but then he named them as the primary reason, perhaps, for why he issued his motu proprio, in essence, abolishing, or let's say abrogating, the motu proprio of Pope Benedict XVI. But he didn't specify what their status is. So the best I can do in this case, Michelle, is to refer you to somebody who has a great deal more insight into this issue, and that is Father John Zulsdorf. He goes by Father Z online. And I quoted and linked to an article that he wrote within the past, say, 6-8 months on this very question. He goes through specific point-by-point details, and I think it's a very fair and honest and accurate way of answering your question. And you can find that on my Twitter feed if you go there at Patrick Madrid. Just type in at Patrick Madrid and then Father Z and you'll find it. I'll try to bump it up for you so you can read it more easily. But I would refer you to his analysis, okay?
Okay, and then my second question was regarding the Novus Ordo, because my mother goes to a Latin Mass that's not SSPX. And she... So I don't know. This whole thing ended up making me look into the Novus Ordo Mass, and I kind of got, this might sound conspiratorial, but I, you know, this is what I discovered, is that, you know, Novus Ordo obviously means new order, which is kind of weird considering like all the COVID stuff. Some people think this is New World Order and that the Pope is in on that. And so then I was looking into the author of the Novus Ordo and came to Annabelle Bagnini. And, you know, and I read this article about him that saying that the whole purpose of that mass being written was to be more welcoming to Protestants, and that the name Annabelle means grace of the God of Baal, which I looked up, and that's true. And so, I don't know, the whole thing kind of freaked me out. So I'm like, which way do I go? Like, I understand why the SSPX is formed. When I read those articles, it scares me. I don't want to be following the wrong thing.
I understand, and I appreciate your sincerity, because that's the main thing, is we want to do what's right in the eyes of God. Sometimes it's not entirely clear what the right thing to do is, so we do our best. So number one, read that article by Father Z. At this next break, I'll make sure that I bump it up to the top so you can find it more easily. The name of the priest in question, Annibale Bunini, he was a close collaborator with Pope Paul VI and with a number of the bishops, especially those from Germany, who were intent upon the revision of the Mass. And yes, he was definitely an influence on this issue, no doubt about it. There is a very good book by Yves Chiron, C-H-I-R-O-N, about Annibale Bunini, and I would encourage you to read it. I think it's published by Angelico Press. I mean, I have it at home, and I've read the book. It's quite good, but he actually debunked some of the theories about Bunini. And even though I would regard Bunini as a figure who caused a lot of damage in his own way, I don't think he was the nefarious, intending to do something evil necessarily the way he's often made out to be. I wish he hadn't done what he had done. But in any case, that book by Yves Chiron, I think, would be a very helpful counterweight to some of the things that you may have been reading. In any case, if you want a firsthand account of what took place at the Second Vatican Council by somebody who was there, I would read the book called The Rhine Flows into the Tiber by Father Ralph Wiltgen, W-I-L-T-G-G-E-N, I believe it is. And he was, as a trained journalist, he was in charge of the English language press office that would disperse the various reports and accounts of the council as it took place. So he was there on the ground at the council, and he was reporting on this. So this book that he wrote, The Rhine Flows into the Tiber, is in essence a distillation of his perception of how things went down and who said what and who did what. And it's very, very helpful to understanding this. And the title, The Rhine Flows into the Tiber, is a way of saying that the German bishops especially were, let's say inordinately influential in the shaping of the eventual council documents. So the Tiber River being in Rome, of course. So if you want something that will give you a balanced appreciation for what happened there, that book, I think, will be helpful in that regard. But the main thing is this. Just remember that as a Catholic, you and I are followers of Jesus Christ. And Jesus promised, he says, On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, Matthew 16. In Matthew 28, Michelle, Jesus said, "Behold, I'm with you always, even until the end of the world." Jesus said, "I will not leave you orphans." These promises that he made over and over again about how the church would survive and continue, even though it might be battered along the way, it would still continue. So the best advice I can give you is, stay a faithful Catholic, stay in the church, don't be talked out of your birthright, continue receiving the sacraments. You're going to be able to receive as spiritually fruitful the sacraments in a Novus Ordo parish, to use that term, the new rite of the Mass, as you would at a traditional Latin Mass. The efficacy, the power of Christ working the sacraments is no different in one form or the other. The externals may be more appealing in one form or the other, and the beauty may be superior in one form versus another, but those things don't touch the essence of the sacraments themselves. So you can receive just as spiritually, beneficially, and fruitfully in your soul when you go to Mass at your local Catholic parish down the street as you would at a traditional Latin Mass. And this is where I think some people might get a little bit...
SSPX.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
with going to the SSPX, do you think that that's kind of like putting myself in danger, or
I myself? Yeah, I myself have never attended an SSPX chapel, and I never will, unless and until they become reconciled with the church in some definitive way. And even though I'm sympathetic to many of their concerns, and I have some of the same concerns myself, nonetheless, my experience in dealing with SSPX folk, including some clergy, is that there's a very, very pronounced hostility to pretty much everyone else in the church, and a condescension and even fury that I've seen both in writing and in person that I think is toxic, and it creates some of the problems that Pope Francis himself is talking about. But for that reason, I don't want to be breathing that atmosphere. There's a lot of harm.
I get that, because I do sense that. But I just, one last question. I don't want to take up too much time, but in New Jersey, I don't know how it was in the rest of the country, but in New Jersey, there was no church to go to other than the SSPX. So I'm wondering, is it like if we lock down again, which
be?
Some people are afraid might happen?
There were probably. You're talking about during the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, during the pandemic, there was nowhere to go. But you know, the SSPX, they were having mass in the parking lot. You could still receive communion. And so I'm wondering, is it better to watch Novus Ordo, or?
Yeah, I'm not here to judge anybody, nor am I here to tell you what you should do, but I wouldn't do that. I would wait until, this is what we did. We waited until our parish church opened back up again. God bless you, Michelle. Hang in there and read that article. I'm going to bump it up to the top of my Twitter feed. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right, we're back. Let's go straight to the phones and talk to Dan in Sominock, Illinois. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Patrick. I'm calling because of the Latin Mass changes. And I'm a Novus Ordo going person. I don't have time to drive to different churches because of my situation. I don't envy them. I mean, I envy them in a way that they go out of their way to do more. And I don't think this should be discouraged. And it feels like a sort of holy socialist action for him to take away the opportunity for people to go the extra mile.
I'm not clear who we're talking about. So,
what I'm saying is that to satisfy the many, it seems that he's taking away this option to the few who want to go a little more and strive to be holier.
And you're referring to Pope Francis, right?
Yes, I'm talking about Pope Francis.
Okay.
I think, like you said, religion is not a competitive sport. And too many people make it out to be that way on both sides. And if Pope Francis would have just come out with a writing issuing that statement, and that people should stop trying to compete against each other, it would have been a lot more effective, instead of entrenching this idea that there is something intrinsically wrong with this pontiff, in my opinion.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is one of those pastoral decisions that in time, it will become very clear whether or not it was a wise pastoral decision or not. And let's face it, some popes have made some disastrous pastoral decisions in the past. Some popes have made some brilliant ones that were not necessarily popular at the time. I personally, I'm not pope. I never will be. My wife won't let me. But I personally would not have done this. I don't think it was something that was required by the circumstances. But then again, I'm not the Pope, so I don't have any say in this issue. But we have a right to be able to say, does this seem like a good thing to do? Because it's a disciplinary issue. It's a legal matter. It's not doctrine, per se. So we have the latitude to be able to discuss it and consider it and look at it. Was this well-advised? Was it ill-advised? I mean, I saw, for example, I read this morning a letter from Cardinal Zen, who is he's the retired cardinal of Hong Kong. And he said, in his response to the motu proprio, he says, you know, there was this letter that said that a questionnaire was sent out to all the bishops around the world. And I read the questions in the questionnaire that were published yesterday. He says, I never got it. So I never got a questionnaire. I was never told about a questionnaire. He says, I was actually on, you know, one of the ranking members on the church's Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments, which is the very dicastery that's, as Pope Francis has said, is in charge of adjudicating these matters. He says, I was a member of that very dicastery, and no one ever said anything about this survey. I never got a copy of it. And I think by implication, what he's saying is, I wonder if that was true of other bishops who maybe never also received an opportunity to weigh in on this issue. So there's a murkiness about all this that is difficult to understand. And as I say, time will tell, things will become clearer. But in the meantime, I think we can all take some encouragement in the fact that the bishops of this country, who are being faithful and obedient to Pope Francis, they are doing what he said when he said, you have the competence in your diocese to make these decisions. And they are making the decision to let the traditional Latin Mass continue. So only in one or two instances have I heard of bishops that are basically shutting things down in that regard. Most of the bishops, including the Archbishop of the Military Vicariate, whose letter I read today, have been saying, all of you who have been saying the traditional Latin Mass or attending it, you can continue to do so. And we're going to study the situation and see what steps we might need to take in the meantime. So I find that very heartening, that by and large, the bishops of this country, it seems, have been very quick to not shut down the traditional Latin Mass, as some feared would happen. I think that's a good sign. It's a positive sign, I think.
It is. Thank you for your time, Pat.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jonathan now in Newfoundland, Canada. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. I have a family planning question for you.
Okay.
My wife and I have a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and 2 2-year-olds.
Okay.
And,
twins?
We're in the obviously. Process. Sorry?
I'm just saying they're twins, obviously.
They're identical twins. They're the cutest things you ever saw.
Beautiful.
We are in the process of discerning the next child, and there's a lot of factors at play. But one of my reservations, I guess, is kind of the you like to get that personal time with each kid, and I know as yourself, I think you have some wisdom in this area because you had 11 kids. I'm curious as to your thoughts on, you know, personal time with each kid. How do you make that a reality when you've got, you know, when you've got lots of children in play and you're trying to cook supper or whatever, you have all these responsibilities on top of trying to spend quality time with the kids. So my reason for, you know, postponing the next child might be, you know, let's wait until kids are a little more self-sufficient so we can give them each their dedicated time. I don't know where I stand on that, and that's just looking for your advice or wisdom.
Happy to give it. What I experienced, Jonathan, is that, as of course, when you have one child, you can devote all of your energies to that child, and then you have two children, then you can sort of do the same for each, and then by the time you have three kids, you have four children. You have four children. That's right. It's what I experienced was you just sort of do it as best you can when you can. And it's not, strictly speaking, necessary that you spend alone time with each individual child on every day. That's usually impossible given the busy schedule that you and your family have. So
I agree.
It all seemed to work out fine. You know, just deal with the kids as a group, deal with them individually when you can, if there's time for that, father-son time or father-daughter time. And so I did things like that. I would take my daughters on their very first date, typically when they were like 7 years old, 8 years old, they'd go on their first date with dad. And we go out to a nice restaurant or go see a movie or do something fun like that, and they get all dressed up. That doesn't have to happen constantly. So as the kids get older, it seemed to me at least that having special times with dad were good and sufficient. And the rest of the time, it was just you're part of the mix and we're living together as a family. So that's how it worked for me. My thinking would be to, you know, just ask God to bless you with whatever children he wants you to have, and also bless you with the time necessary to be a good dad for them. And he will. He'll give you what you need to do your job as long as you ask him for it and cooperate with it. That'd be my suggestion.
Sure. And you wouldn't have any reservations with respect to that particular issue. I think that's the only thing standing between me and our you know, being exceptionally open to our next child.
Which particular issue was that? I must have missed that one.
Just being able to make sure that you've given, you know, enough, you have enough time to go around for all of your children. That's.
It certainly didn't pose a problem for me. I can only share my own experience with you. I didn't feel bothered by that at all. And it's just a fact of life that as you get older and you have more children, and as they get older and they're busier with other things, when they're little, like your kids are all still at home, they haven't gone to school yet. So you have that luxury of being able to focus on them and be with them much more than you would when they get into school and start playing sports and piano practice and all that stuff. So it's just a natural progression in family life, it seems to me, that you have less and less time for each individual child. But that's okay, and things will work out. And I don't know that they need that specific time with you on a daily basis. I'm not sure that's necessary. And families can flourish using this model that I'm proposing. But one thing for sure, though, is I would not, for me personally, I would not see that as a reason to avoid conception. To me, that would not rise to the level of a serious enough reason to do that. Right, right.
Okay. I think we can both agree with that. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I wish you.
That's all. Just looking for some outside input on this discernment.
My pleasure to be of service. I wish you and your wife many happy years together. And if it's God's will, may he bless you with many happy and healthy children. I'm sure you're going to be a great dad for all of them. Let's go now to Marguerite, listening in Brookfield, Wisconsin. Hi, Marguerite.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. First of all, I want to apologize. The last time I called, I thought I was doing you a favor. I said, just tell Patrick whatever I wanted. And then I learned you don't want that. So I'm sorry. I won't do that again.
I'm not sure what you did wrong, but that's okay. Go ahead, Marguerite.
Okay. I have some books that I need that I, you know, I'm traveling and I don't get to write down. Do you know of a prayer book for a young man? He's a sophomore in college.
Okay. And you're looking for a prayer book, is that right?
Yeah.
I like a book called Handbook of Prayers. It's published by, it's a Midwest Theological Forum, I believe. Let me see if I can find it here. I don't have it in my studio. I've got it at home. But it is a beautiful manual of prayers that comes, it's in English, and it comes in a very nice format, kind of like a Bible, but it's not that big. And it is, it's been around for probably 30 years or so. And I found it very helpful. I've taken it with me all around the world. So yeah, that's the title is called Handbook of Prayers. And it's just very nice. It's sturdy and it's attractive looking and it's chock full of beautiful prayers, devotions,
and hopefully he'll use it.
Hopefully he'll use it. That's right.
Yeah. And the next book is that one on hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I actually bought it, but I gave it away.
Uh-huh.
What is the name of that?
That one's called The Dogma of Hell. And if you want to see a picture of it, go to Relevant.
I had it. I had it. But can I get it on Relevant Radio?
Well, here's what you can do. If you go to relevantradio.com and click on the link for where it says links, and then you'll see the link for the book on hell. Just click on that and you can order it there. You won't be ordering it from Relevant Radio, but it's a link that I think goes to Amazon, if I'm not mistaken. So that's what I would suggest. Marguerite, God bless you, and thanks for calling in today. We'll get a link to this, we'll get a link to this book called Handbook of Prayers from the Midwest Theological Forum, the one that I've had for many years. I really like it. So we'll get a link to that so you can see what it's all about if you're interested. We'll be right back with more right after this. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
You know what? I announced on Twitter yesterday that I'm going to have a presence on Substack. And you say, Substack? What is Substack? Substack's a place, it's kind of like a blog where you can have newsletters and things like that. I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to do there, but I'm just letting you know. So patrickmadrid.substack.com is where I'll be doing some writing in the not-too-distant future. We'll see how that goes. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Joseph in Minneapolis. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Patrick. Regarding the Novus Ordo and the traditional extraordinary form of the Mass, Scott Hahn offers us a commentary regarding that on YouTube, and it's called The Traditional Mass is Objectively Superior. I think it would be a good thing for listeners to listen and watch. On one hand, yeah, how could anyone argue with your words that Mass is Mass, Mass is valid, whether it's Eucharist? At the same time, how does it not please God to show him every reverence that we possibly can? Is there a difference in having Mass in my driveway as opposed to what church tradition teaches is acceptable or is not acceptable?
Of course.
Much as you've described in the past about receiving communion on the tongue, the act of adoration doesn't diminish what you're receiving, but it's because it's still Jesus. But we can please God by giving him every reverence that we possibly can. And in the traditional Mass, it seems that's what's taking place. You had mentioned during COVID that there were people that were driving 4 hours in California so they could attend FSSP, the Fraternal Society of St. Peter, or the Priestly Society of St. Peter. And there's a reason why those parishes are so strong, and it's because it goes beyond what's valid. It's about pleasing God in every way we possibly can. When somebody is on the beaches of Iwo Jima and they're receiving the Eucharist on their knees, how pleasing that must be to God. They're giving every reverence that they possibly can.
Yeah, I get it. Moment. I get it. And you and I are in complete agreement. But you have to keep in mind the distinctions that I've been making, Joseph, in terms of the subjective superiority. And when I'm using the term subjective, what I mean by this is that from an aesthetic standpoint, I completely agree that the traditional Mass is superior. No question about it. In terms of the precision and the beauty of the prayers, it's more comprehensive. It's certainly the organic growth in a liturgical sense of the early Mass. And so you and I have no disagreement on that point, in my view. But the point I was making, or rather the distinction I was making, is that in its essence, the Mass is the Mass is the Mass, independent of the externals. Now, you asked me, would it be, in essence, I think what you're asking me is would it be the same to have Mass in your driveway rather than, say, Mass in a beautiful parish? Well, obviously not. it wouldn't be the same. It's certainly the experience would not be the same. The glory to God would not be the same. The growth in holiness, for example, maybe for the people who are going to be less edified by a mass in your driveway. No one's arguing those points. I don't dispute those points at all. I think they're self-evidently true. But you have to keep those distinct, Joseph, from the theological point I was making, and that is that just as in the upper room, there were no there was no Latin, there were no bells rung, there were no elaborate vestments, there was no incense, and yet that Mass is as supreme and efficacious as any other Mass is. And that's an important distinction to keep in mind, because you're arguing about, or you're not arguing, but you're bringing up the issue of the externals, and I agree with you on that, but there is this distinction we have to keep in mind.
May I add something, Patrick?
Please.
Patrick? Thank you. Okay. Yes, and I think it's important to note too that the example you're using is when the church was described as a mustard seed, and the externals are important because they are opportunities for us to not only show greater reverence, but also.
And I agree with
they
you.
Are opportunities.
Do you want to disagree with me? Because what you're saying, I'm telling you, I agree with you.
I just want to recognize that the opportunities for grace by, and I think you're agreeing with me, but, and so I don't think that point should go unacknowledged, because when we
Nor
take
has
away
it.
Opportunities for grace.
Nor has it gone unacknowledged, Joseph. This is a theme I've touched upon many times.
Okay. Well, I can't understand any rationale for taking away opportunities for graces, and that's what it appears is being done with people who celebrate the traditional Mass.
As I say, if I were Pope, that's not a decision that I would have made, but I'm not Pope, so I have to live with the decisions that the Pope makes. So we do the best we can under the circumstances, right? Even if it may not be
right.
What we would like.
Right. Yeah. Well, I want you to know that I appreciate very much your program and getting to hear all that you do share with us.
Thank you.
And I hope that what I've said to you has been anything but respectful. It's not intended in any way other than that. But
I appreciate
anyway,
it.
God bless.
Yeah, thank you, Joseph. And it's good to know in the final analysis that we are approaching this topic from the same perspective. Thank you. Let's go to Peter now in Drift, Texas. That sounds like a cool town, Drift. Where is Drift,
Texas? It's such a
Texas-sounding
name, isn't it, Patrick?
Yeah. Where is it?
So thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller. Driftwood is about 30 miles southwest of Austin.
Okay, very good. I'll have to stop in sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm calling about, Patrick, is in reference to about half an hour ago, there was a Deacon Martin, I believe his name was, talking mm-hmm. about he couldn't understand people being angry after Mass, especially after receiving our Lord in Holy Communion. Mm-hmm. And I would like to address that because I'm a regular goer of Novus Ordo and the traditional Latin Mass, mm-hmm. and I think what he is seeing, at least in my case sometimes, is a righteous anger from the distractions, which seems that the Novus Ordo Mass is more prone to than the traditional Latin Mass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be it the priest inserting his own personality at times when he shouldn't,
right.
Changing the words of the prayers, changing the rubrics, the music being poor, lyrics not truly being liturgical, not to mention the whole circus which, you know, the extraordinary Eucharistic ministers end up performing.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself at many Novus Ordo Masses being quite distracted, whereas when I'm going to the traditional Latin Mass, I know what I'm going to get at every single Mass. And if there's a different priest up there or in different parish, it doesn't matter.
Right.
I know exactly what it is I'm going to get, and I can concentrate on worshiping and receiving my Lord rather than worrying about how all these other things are interfering with my worship. And I guess that's
I
all I wanted to say. Maybe he is just seeing this anger as merely being their reaction to the distractions of not getting what it is they have the right to receive in the Holy Mass.
I have experienced this in a variety of ways, Peter, including the politicization of a sermon by a priest, or efforts to try to customize the mass to fit somebody's whims and preferences. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And if we're keeping our eyes open and are aware, then those things naturally you're going to see them and they're going to have an effect. I don't disagree with you. And I didn't really give enough time to Deacon Martin's comment on that point because we had to press on. But I think maybe he was approaching this from the standpoint of if we really think it through and remember that we're there in spite of the distractions and difficulties that may be there, we're there for Jesus. And if we receive him, then that should transcend the lesser problems, you know, the other things that we're dealing with. And I can see his point. He's making a good point, but that doesn't negate the point that you're making. Yeah. I see it as a both and.
I couldn't agree with him more, and I thank him for his answering the call.
Indeed, indeed. Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate your phone call.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye. Tina in Redding, California. Good morning.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Okay, good. I think your last two guests may have answered my question, but I'm going to ask anyhow. I'm a new convert. We've spoken a couple of times. Anyhow, I've been listening to you speak about the traditional Latin Mass and versus the Mass we go to today, or at least in my parish where there's English and Spanish.
Okay.
Anyhow, what is the real difference? I haven't YouTubed this yet, but what is the real difference between the Latin Mass and the Mass we have today?
Okay. How do I answer that in the space of a minute or two? Let's begin with the premise that a Mass that is validly celebrated for those who are there attending is efficacious and spiritually beneficial and fruitful in itself because of what it is. And that is the essence of the Mass. Whereas the externals of the Mass can vary widely. You can have a Mass in an empty room, or the caller a minute ago talked about having Mass in his driveway. I don't recommend that, obviously, because a big part of our attention at Mass is to glorify God and to worship him in spirit and in truth. So to my mind, those things that help perfect that act of worship by lifting our mind and our thoughts and our hearts to God and the things of God, those are going to, from the standpoint of how they'll help you get more out of Mass, those things are better insofar as if they are able to help you enter in more fully to the Mass and love God and praise God, then that's better than in having Mass in a place where you don't have those helps. But that doesn't affect the Mass itself as such. So these externals are important, but they're not the most important thing. So when it comes to considering the difference between the traditional Latin Mass and the new Mass, remember that the traditional Latin Mass was codified in the form that we would know it today by Pope Pius V going back over 400 years ago. And he made that decision not because he was trying to introduce a new Mass, but because there were so many different kinds of Masses that were being celebrated from one locality to another. And he didn't want that. He wanted the uniformity of the Mass so that Catholics in the Latin Rite everywhere would all experience the same Mass wherever they went. And it would also eliminate the tendency for priests and bishops to customize things to suit their own whims and preferences, because the Mass doesn't belong to the bishop. The Mass doesn't belong to the priest. It doesn't belong to you or me either. It belongs to Christ who has entrusted it to the church. So Pope Pius V, his decision was to make this organic growth of the divine liturgy as it came from the early church forward in the Latin Rite, to make it so that everybody everywhere could experience it the same way. And that was a good decision on his part. The new Mass, or the new rite of the Mass that was promulgated at the Second Vatican Council, was in many respects a departure from some very important aspects of the Mass, the traditional Latin Mass. So among other things, it was to be celebrated in the vernacular. It was to be celebrated with the people actually saying and singing the parts of the Mass. Prior to that, that was not done. and the effort there was given, the reason there was given to have the people be participating fully in the Mass. And by doing it in their own language, the argument went that they'd be able to understand it better, they could participate more. And things that in the new Mass that were omitted, I'm sorry, the things from the old Mass that were omitted in the new Mass were part of the problem. Many prayers were omitted. Some of the prayers were translated in a way that really watered them down. And so the Novus Ordo, or the new rite of the Mass, was in many respects kind of a pale version of the more robust, more beautiful, more precise Mass that was celebrated traditionally. So those are some of the differences. And I keep coming back to this point about the differences are important and the externals are very important, but the essence of the Mass is going to be the same. And this is a topic that deserves much more attention than I was able to give it, but I hope that's a start anyway, Tina. Thank you. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. And as ever, I will be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Good morning. Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.